Thank you for joining our podcast today. We'll be having a discussion with Admiral Scott Swift, former commander of U.S. Pacific Fleet, and Admiral Jamie Fogo, commander of Naval Forces Europe. Today's topic is going to be the submarine industrial base funding and opportunities for industry, as well as the impact of AUKUS and the Australia-U.S. defense equipment sharing effort underneath that program. I'm Jim McCarthy. I'm the Vice President for Naval Programs at Cyprus, and I'll be the host for today's host and moderator for today's discussion, and hope you find it as interesting as we do. Thank you. Gentlemen, good morning, and appreciate your joining us for this podcast. As we told everybody, a discussion of SIB industrial base funding and the Australia-US-UK AUKUS agreements and how those are going to affect timelines and money and the rest of all that in the U.S. DOD. I want to start off by asking Admiral Fogo, you know, AUKUS has been in the news a lot, and there's been confusion over the what that means in terms of DOD investment. You know, are the U.S. and Australia the only ones involved? Are they the only ones putting money on the table? If there is an agreement, are there share lines? Are there partner countries that are involved in this relationship? And, you know, how does this effort benefit the U.S. and our allies? And I'd like Admiral Fogo, if you could take the first stab at that one.
Hey, Jim, thanks very much for inviting me to the podcast. And always good to see my friend Admiral Scott Swift to talk about important subjects like AUKUS. And I think to start off, we have to differentiate between AUKUS Phase 1 and AUKUS Phase 2. So Phase 1 is clearly in my lane. It's about providing Australia with a nuclear-powered submarine force of their own. First and foremost, that's expensive. And secondly, since Australia is not a producer of nuclear submarines, this is going to be something that will be accomplished over the long term. I would just add, note I said nuclear powered and not nuclear capable in terms of nuclear weapons. So these submarines will be nuclear powered, but they're not going to carry nuclear weapons. In Phase 1, we will be providing Virginia-class submarines first in the 2030s, followed by a hybrid US-UK-Australia design to be built first in the United Kingdom. We won't immediately be doing submarine production in Australia because they don't yet have the industrial base to do so. So the bottom line is, to answer your question, this is an agreement between three countries, the United States of America, the United Kingdom, and Australia. And the combination of the United Kingdom submarine design and advanced United States technologies intended to deliver a kind of a best-in-class submarine that meets Australia's long-term defense needs while boosting trilateral industrial cooperation, which is important, you know, because we've kind of outsourced our manufacturing ability in a lot of sectors in the United States and the UK, and we're going to bring it back with this program. So the SSN AUKUS will be the next iteration, the future attack submarine for both Australia and the United Kingdom. And Australia and the United Kingdom intend to start building SSN AUKUS in their domestic shipyards before the end of this decade. So the United Kingdom is going to deliver the first SSN AUKUS to the Royal Navy, the UK Royal Navy, in the late 2030s. That's a ways off, but it's not that far away. You know, we're rolling into 2025 here. So you're talking 15 years, and most acquisition programs take somewhere between 10 and 15 years. Australia then plans to deliver the first Australian-built SSN AUKUS to the Royal Australian Navy in the 2040s. So that gives them a little bit more time. Now, on the other hand, for AUKUS Phase 2, and that's more in Admiral Swift's lane, as far as I'm concerned, the sky's the limit. It's about defense cooperation between like-minded allies and partners that are looking at threats out in the Western Pacific, and there's a lot of them. So we'll start with Phase 2 and a robust relationship between the U.S., the U.K., and Australia, and build from there. You know, there's all sorts of scuttlebutt and rumors out there. What does this mean? You know, I think Admiral Swift can probably talk to this, but, you know, I have no inside scoop. But if you look at Japan and the desire to build missile defense with a partner like the United States, and certainly with Australia, that could be part of AUKUS too, but the ink isn't even wet on any phase two agreements yet. I'm excited about this, really. I think AUKUS is more than just a submarine deal between three friendly allies. It has the potential to be much more, incorporating our collective defense capabilities, our manufacturing capabilities, our innovation, and our technical advances against a growing Chinese and North Korean threat in the Western Pacific. So thanks for the opportunity to comment.
Thanks, Jamie. Natso, do you have anything that you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, again, great to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to join once again, Jim and Cyprus, hosting this podcast series, and especially enjoy sharing the time with Jamie. We're also busy. I don't get enough time to spend quality time with Jamie, so I get as much out of this podcast as I'm sure your listeners do. I think it's really important, and I think this is underscored by Jamie's point, his comments that he's made is, at this point in where we are with AUKUS, and we have come a long way. I mean, there are real things that are happening. This is more in Jamie's lane, but we're actually training Australian sailors in the U.S. Navy nuclear program today. That's a significant step forward. So this isn't something that we continue to admire. There's actually important elements that are in run. But I think it's really important that we should be focused less on the answers and more ensuring all the right questions are being asked and put on the table, because there's some real challenges here. And I think Jamie's framing it in the context of phase one and phase two is important. I would not be too distracted by the individuals that are participating on both sides of the AUKUS discussion, pros and cons. I see it more on the Australian side with Prime Ministers Turnbull and Keating's public comments about their concerns. And I'll talk more about it later in the podcast, what my concerns are. Almost all my concerns are in phase one, is the executability of the program. Phase two is a no-brainer in my part. This is all about integrated deterrence. We are much stronger as a combined force, we the United States, than we are as an individual force. That is the strongest endorsement that I can make for getting phase one right. Because if you can't get phase one right, we will never get to phase two, which is really where the core of our individual and combined national security interests lie. So we will be much stronger as AUKUS continues to develop. I would suggest we're already getting there, as I said, with some of the phase one efforts that are in run. I'll close on Jamie's last point. I would be very cautious about expanding phase two partners because phase one is so difficult. Now, Jamie knows this better than anybody else. The shore infrastructure that's required across the board, not just for supporting the submarine itself, but the man, train, and equip, all of those elements. It's very complex. You have to stay focused on it. I'm, as an aviator, I'm fond of saying 80% is good enough 90% of the time. Don't say that to a submariner. It is 99% of the time, and you know this as a nuke yourself, Jim, you cannot afford to get that wrong. And so I Australia and UK understand this, and that's why their debate is so robust. So I'm very cautious about expanding phase two partners at this point. Let's continue getting phase one right. Let's build out phase two. As Jamie well said, the ink's not wet yet. Let's let that dry a little bit before we start expanding the consortium, if you will. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. That's appreciate that answer. And we'll start that. I want to follow on with, you alluded to the fact that there were people who didn't necessarily agree with AUKUS, the effort that we're pursuing. The potential shift of administration could change the dynamics in this. From your experience as the PAC fleet commander, to those that oppose the AUKUS and the information data sharing, what would you say to them, and how does this fit into the Indo-PACOM strategy for deterrence and war-winning posture?
So this is another great question. I would make three points here, and I'm saying this in my old hat. I won't speak for those that followed me or those that are in the job now as the PAC fleet commander. I spent most of my time with allies, partners, and friends. And so we talk about AUKUS, but as Jamie alluded to, we have to include the other countries to explain to them, how does it play in their relationship with, I mean, we'll make it simple, the U.S. Navy. It expands out to the U.S. industry and U.S. government as well, but I'll just stick to this point of the U.S. Navy and Pacific Fleet in particular. So we have to remain engaged with allies, partners, and friends in a debate and a dialogue about how they should see themselves in that broader context. Are they being excluded? Somehow they are not a prime partner of the United States because they're not part of AUKUS. That is absolutely not true. But we need to continue the broad focus that we've taken with respect to allies, partners, and friends. So that's the first point. Second point I alluded to earlier, and that is this debate is important. So we should embrace it. Every question should be addressed as a prime issue. Because it's relevant to our national security to get this right. We got to be worried about black swans and blind spots. And if key allies and partners don't understand this, whether they're in government or out of government, if they're in a different country's defense, wherever it may be, we need them on board with at least having the right answers. And the U.S. government, the Australian government, and the U.K. government as a triad are the right people to address those questions. Because if you don't address those questions, you're never going to get to that power of a combined force, much stronger as a combined force than we are individually. And the third point is that last point that I just made. We're significantly stronger as a combined force, as allies, partners, and friends. So this is, if you remember the pivot, Jim, people in Europe were feeling like they were left out, the pivot to the Pacific. And I spent a lot of time explaining to them, made a trip to Europe, as a matter of fact, to say that it wasn't a shift away to Europe. It was a shift to include the Pacific. And Jamie was there in Europe at that time, carrying that water as well. So the three points being is we need to include those that are not part of the AUKUS, the triad, in this debate. The debate is important. And we have to understand the reason that debate is important, because we're far stronger as a combined force of allies and partners. And some will feel excluded. They won't feel completely integrated unless their questions are addressed, you know, appropriately.
Thank you, Admiral Swift. Admiral Fogo, anything you'd like to add to that?
Admiral Swift appropriately brought up the training for Australian submariners in our nuclear power schools and the nuclear power school of the United Kingdom. You know, I was pleasantly surprised at that. Naval Reactors that grew up under Admiral Hyman G. Rickover was a very closed-looped organization. And I'm preaching to the choir, Jim. You're a nuke like me. You know that. You went through nuke power school. Everything was kind of under this rubric of naval nuclear propulsion information and kept, you know, classified and in-house. And so opening that opportunity for training up to officers and enlisted personnel in the Royal Australian Navy, I think, is huge on the part of the United States. So those officers over a year ago arrived in the United States. They've gone through our nuclear power school. We've had a couple of tranches of candidates, small numbers, you know, threes and fours. And I was told, you know, by the Australian Naval Attaché, they picked their best and brightest engineers from some of the best schools in the country. And as they went through, they felt like you and me, Jim. It was hard. You know, as our friend Trip Barber says, hard is authorized, but you are drinking from the fire hose as you go through this pipeline. And then you go to prototype, you know, a real nuclear powered submarine alongside. And then you go to submarine school, and it's a little bit of a breather, and that's very enjoyable. And now these officers are out in the U.S. and U.K. respective fleets doing a right seat, left seat kind of qualification. They're already very good submariners, excellent submariners down in Australia, because they have the Collins class submarines. And so we're going to see both enlisted personnel and officer personnel from Australia on our boats. And I think that's great. My first boat, just before I left, we got an exchange officer from the United Kingdom. It was Commander Stanhope, who later became the first Sea Lord. And he had been commanding officer of a diesel boat, was going to a nuke. This was kind of his kiddie cruise, as we call it, on a deployed submarine going into one of the toughest missions that we do from the East Coast on USS Sea Devil. And what it did for the United States Navy is share best practices of both navies. And we benefit from that. And I think that gets back to what Admiral Swift said on this is the essence of integrated deterrence. Furthermore, we just had the three service chiefs down there. So the First Sea Lord, the CNO of the Australian Navy, and Admiral Franchetti were down for the Indian Ocean Defense Seminar and stopped by RMAS Stirling in Australia, which is where we're going to be doing these port visits of Virginia-class submarines and, you know, maybe other support ships who will be going in there between now and the 2030s when Australia picks up its first 3 to 5 Virginia classes and get them used to how we do maintenance, how we do training, and how we do deployment of these ships. And to have the three service chiefs down there to underscore the importance of doing this right, I think was absolutely essential. So I'm very happy to see that happen as well. So all goodness, and, you know, be monitoring this very closely as we move forward.
Thanks, Jamie. Let's get to the nuts and bolts of this, too. The AUKUS has a lot of money in it, AUKUS phase one anyway. Submarine industrial base keeps having money added to it. Matter of fact, it's the number one thing on the CNO's unfunded priority list to add more money to submarine industrial base efforts. Given that the current industrial base can only do about 1.2 submarines a year, and with the AUKUS agreement and the Columbia class, we've got that requirement to do 1 plus 2.33 or one ballistic missile submarine plus two Virginia class for the United States plus a third of Virginia class for the Australians. How likely is the submarine industrial base can meet this demand, and how do they get there?
Well, Jim, thanks for the question. And that's a loaded question. It's going to be a real challenge. But, you know, the one thing about our country is Americans rise to a challenge. And I think this is executable, but it's going to require an exquisite plan as we move forward and a lot of resources. And we're seeing a lot of resources. You know, we had that $6 billion supplemental, you know, from the budget that's earmarked for building submarines. And I think you make some great points and you raise some valid concerns. As you pointed out, you know, Congress has been funding 2.0 Virginias per year, but we're only able to build, and, you know, my numbers come in at somewhere between 1.2 and 1.4, you know, depending on who you talk to. But the bottom line, it's not 2.0. And now we're adding this additional requirement of an additional third of a submarine, so one boat every 3 years to satisfy the requirements of AUKUS to get the Australians 3 to 5 between 2030 and 2040. There's a lot of reasons why we've kind of fallen behind in the industrial base and production of submarines. And I think it's explainable. It's something we've got to fix. But if you look at modernization of the Los Angeles class boats, and I was a commanding officer of USS Oklahoma City, which was SSN 723, an LA boat, Fairwater Plains Flight 1, we've had some problems. You know, people are aware who are in this industry of the story of USS Boise. It's kind of the poster child for the problems we're discussing, 7 years alongside without a refueling or a modernization, because we just didn't have the capacity in dry docks to fulfill the backlog in maintenance. There's been a lot of news reporting in the last year about how many submarines are in maintenance and modernization. That's 40% of our fleet. Ideally, we want to get the number of attack submarines up to 66, but we're currently hovering around 50. So when you do the math, you take 40% of 50 boats, you know, that's 20 that are in maintenance. That means 30 on a good day can get underway and go out and do the nation's business for national security around the globe. If you divide that up evenly between three combatant commanders, CENTCOM, EUCOM, and PAYCOM, and there's, we know from being inside the building as long or longer than I have been, that there's tugging and pulling between COCOMs. Everybody wants submarines. And so, you know, 30 is not enough. That's why we want to push that number up to 66 eventually sometime in the 2040s. And it takes, you know, three boats to get one deployed. So you always got a boat in maintenance and a boat in training and a boat deployed. That's typically what we do in rotation for the surface fleet or the submarine force. Now you can violate those rules in the fleet response training plan, and you can, you know, not do maintenance. That's been part of the problem, and send a boat to sea, or you can shortchange training, and that's not optimal either, because you can have problems due to lack of training. But, you know, maintenance and modernization of overhauls of these existing platforms are supposed to be done by our public yards. And ideally, we should be down around 18% of the inventory of attack submarines in maintenance at any one time. You know, so that's more like, if we had 66, that'd be like 11 boats. That's what we program for. But we haven't been able to do that because our public yards have fallen behind. Why? Because they're old, because they need modernization themselves. You can't just modernize the fleet. You got to modernize the infrastructure. And so we created the shipyard integrated optimization plan. And there was a lot of money earmarked for that a few years ago, somewhere in the realm of $21 billion. But as far as refurbishment of dry docks was concerned, you know, if my memory serves, and you've got an expert, Dave Armour, on the staff that knows these numbers better than me, we allocated about $7 billion for dry dock refurbishment, maybe 7.8, something like that, of the $21 billion for the four public yards. So when you divide that up by four, it's just not enough money to refurbish those docks. We've done one up in Portsmouth. You know, I was up on the Hill last year talking to Senator Susan Collins. I love her. She's great. She loves the Navy. And she wanted to tell me how she had walked through this newly renovated dockyard in Portsmouth with CNO Mike Gilday and how pleased both of them were with that job. So we've got to do that in Pearl. We've got to do that in Puget. And we've got to do that in Norfolk. And those facilities down in Norfolk, some of them were constructed during the Civil War. So they are in dire need of an upgrade. And, you know, we took Puget offline because we had some seismic issues and had to go, you know, undergird the structure of the docks to make sure that if there was earthquake activity, we didn't have any problems. The other thing we've done is we're famous for this. We're going to extend ships on deployment. You know, back in the day when you and I were ensigns, Jim, it was kind of a mark of your stamina to stay at sea longer than your predicted deployment time. And not only does that kind of screw up plans for families, it also perturbs the chain of custody and the plan for maintenance. So all this planning that goes into a maintenance availability for a submarine or an aircraft carrier, if you extend that unit for a couple of months, and you know those carriers, Ike and Ford, were extended from 7 to 9 months because of the results of what was going on in the Middle East and the Red Sea. It's like running a train down the tracks, you know, a fast speed train, high velocity train, and then just putting the brakes on. And as you do that, every one of those cabins up to the caboose behind go ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. So you get this line outside the minimum, you know, number of dry docks that we have in the nation waiting to go in, and all those work packages have to be redone again. That's why we're getting behind. So we got to get on with the PSYOP, got to get the number right. The Navy smartly decided that they'd go study this and come back with a number in 2025. So that's next year. And I think that number is going to be much higher than the $21 billion originally allocated. And I think that's going to be a little shock factor to Capitol Hill. But if we want to be able to fix these problems, we're going to have to write the check. And you got guys like Dave at Cypress that know, Dave Armour, that know this backwards and forwards. So I think if there are people out there, industries out there that can help, then we need them to help. And we can certainly paint a picture for them on how they can go about plugging in and helping us with the public yards. Now, PSYOP, there's no money earmarked in PSYOP for the private yards. And so, you know, Electric Boat, General Dynamics, Huntington Ingalls, those that do some submarine repair, they're left out. What Huntington Ingalls and Newport News tried to do was, when the Navy got behind in public yards with modernization and repair of 688 class submarines, they said, okay, well, we've got some excess dock space down here, and they had to kind of bring it back from, you know, being dormant, and we can put the 688s in those docks and we can work on them. Problem was labor, so, and experience, because they hadn't done a 688 modernization in a long time. But they're, you know, they're a can-do organization, like all Americans. Yep, we can do this. I think they borrowed some of the labor from the carrier construction. And those folks, if you take them off a carrier dry dock or on deck on a carrier and you send them down to a 688 and say, go modernize the 688, there's a learning curve. And there's, you know, obviously some delays that are going to be plugged in there. And that's what happened. It's apples and oranges. You know, these systems are not plug and play. They're not interchangeable. You know, I used to say to my guys on the 688 class nuclear submarine is equally as complex as a space shuttle. We're just in a different domain. We're underwater at high pressure with all this, you know, electrical power, weapons, nuclear power, batteries. all that stuff is dangerous, and you've got to make sure that when the ship goes to sea, that it is properly outfitted and ready. So that set us back a little bit based on the best intentions to try to help the Navy get those ships out. We're recovering from that. And the labor problem is being addressed in the submarine industrial base. And there's a lot of resources going into labor because you can't just have yards. You've got to have the people with the skills to be able to fix the boats and get them back to sea. So let me stop there.
Well, you brought up the point that the next area I wanted to delve into, and it is the availability of the labor market. How much money of the SIB funding is going towards improving labor condition? And, you know, given that the unemployment rates are running in the, you know, 3% to 4% range below structural unemployment, is it realistic to think that we can get workers to fill these gaps in the submarine industrial base and not take them from the maintenance side? Or, you know, how do we do this in a way that works to get submarine industrial base capacity increased without losing ground on maintenance and without creating a demand in the labor market that just raises labor costs that then translate into higher costs that we can't afford for, you know, new ships and maintenance availabilities?
One thing that has happened over the course of more than 100 years since the Industrial Revolution is that America has learned that you have to take care of your workers and their families. And so our rates of pay have escalated, and that has increased the cost of maintenance, repair, and new construction of ships. And this is a vicious circle, right? So it's not just the submarine industrial base and facilities and companies that build submarines that need labor. The Navy needs labor for refresh of its 345,000 personnel. So we're in competition with those young men and women that are going to go out and defend the nation forward. And the rest of the industrial base, who are doing other great things in space and cyber in manufacturing, they need quality people, well-educated people, or trained blue-collar workers as well. So this competition is vicious. And so in order to alleviate, you know, the labor challenges, NAVC and industry have embarked on a kind of a public-private partnership. And let me tell you, you know, one of my good friends, and you know him really well, Hondo Gertz. Hondo waxes eloquently on how important it is to have a public-private partnership, to work together as Americans to solve our problems, because the bottom line is, you know, the defense of the United States will maintain our economy, maintain our freedom, and maintain our democracy. And so it's in all of our best interests to be able to work together on this. And I think we learned that lesson through the College of Hard Knocks over time, but I think people are starting to get it. You've seen a lot of commercials on TV, and I love them. You know, build submarine commercials where the boat is skulking through the ocean undetected and you can hear a ping from sonar. I mean, yeah, I guess my blood and juices flowing there. I think it's great. And it's attracting young people to the trades. And, you know, one of the things young people are looking at today is, do I want to go to a 4-year college and end up with $100,000 in debt or more? Or would I prefer to enter, you know, the program for apprentices that a company like Newport News has, where they recruit very competitive. They recruit several hundred young men and women every year to come in, and they're trained and educated in math and science, and then in the trades. And, you know, after a certain period of time, between 2 and 4 years, they're going down to the docks and they're working. They go from apprentice to craftsman. And before you know it, they're on the payroll and they're making a very good salary as a welder or a ship fitter, and they don't have any debt. And so I think that's becoming increasingly more attractive to Americans. And so the challenge is that the submarine industrial base has set its goal for labor to recruit 10,000 builders a year for 10 years for a total of 100,000 builders. I'm excited about that. I want to rebuild our manufacturing capability in this country, and I think that's the right way to go. Now, can we do it? I think the numbers are looking pretty good. In 2023, they made their quota shy of a few hundred, and that's amazing. You know, like I said, you've seen the commercials on TV. There are companies like Blue Forge Alliance, which is kind of the prime for Naval Sea Systems Command to help them do this, and another company called Serco that's out there making it happen. And how do you do that? There's been, you know, commercials on TV with Rosie the Riveter and the welders in the trades that are attracting young Americans, because it is debt-free and potentially lucrative to get these skills. I mean, welders, they make a pretty good paycheck, and they have excellent skills that are marketable in more than just shipyards. So then the challenge after that is to retain them. You know, some folks say, okay, why don't we build more shipyards? Well, that's great, but you got to put the horse before the cart. The problem right now, in my humble opinion, is labor. So let's get the labor right. And then as we start to build up this bank of young Americans who are in our manufacturing and industrial base, then we can think about adding more yard capacity and putting some of that labor in those yards. I mean, you've heard me say this before. And I said it at Sea Air Space this year with the Honorable Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Nicholas Girton, on the dais. And I said, you know, sir, one of my favorite books is Freedom's Forge by Arthur Herman. And he goes, yeah, I've read that book. You know, at the end of World War II, in building the arsenal of democracy, Franklin Roosevelt had Knudsen and Kaiser, president and CEO of GM and the biggest shipbuilder in the country, come to Washington and work for a dollar a year to rebuild our arsenal of democracy and our industrial base. And these guys did it. The numbers in the book are staggering, you know, tens of thousands of aircraft and ships and tanks and machine guns and artillery that went on to the Pacific, the fight in the Pacific and the fight in the Atlantic to defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. At the end of World War II, on the East Coast, West Coast, Gulf Coast, we had 55 shipyards. And when Cap Weinberger and President Reagan, you know, Secretary Weinberger is one of my favorite defense secretaries, and President Reagan came in, that number had dwindled to 19 shipyards. And today we have 7 shipyards, simply not enough to do what we need to do for AUKUS carrier construction or anything else. You know, destroyers, frigates, we need more capacity. But labor is the Achilles heel, and we just don't have enough. So I think the SIB has got it right. They talk about in the SIB, the bumper sticker, the mantra is, you know, 1+2.33. I really think that the Navy, and particularly some of the folks that I've talked to in the Navy, say it's 1 Columbia class plus 2 Virginias plus AUKUS. So they don't specify 0.33 because I think that number is a moving target. And then sustainment. You can't talk about new construction acquisition without looking at sustainment over life. We make that mistake over and over and over again. And, you know, I used to work for Mark Ferguson. And when Mark was VCNO, he would say, you know, I'd bring folks in that were building destroyers. He was a SWO and a nuke like you, Jim. And he would say, okay, you know, to my classmate, Naval Sea Systems Commander, Admiral Hilardis, okay, Willie, how are we paying for sustainment of these great ships? And sometimes we don't have good answers about that. So I'm very proud of the fact that, you know, the admirals and the staffs that are on active duty today are talking about 1 Columbia, 2 Virginias, AUKUS, we need to make that happen, and sustainment for all of that.
Thanks very much. Admiral Swift, I want to go to you, to make any comments you have on the last two questions I've talked with Admiral Fogo about. I'd also like you to talk to the issue of, you know, foreign ownership of U.S. yards, you know, for instance, Hanwha, you know, purchasing Philadelphia Shipyard from Acker. And, you know, do you allow them to bring workers from overseas into the United States to work on this kind of stuff? Is that a realistic expectation? Are there other entrants coming into this? And if there's not, you know, we have this total increase in labor demand against a fixed population. How does that work out? Admiral Swift?
Yeah, so...
I've given you the easy question.
Yeah, well, let me give you an easy answer. I'm going to chuckle as I was listening to Jamie. So the answer is going to be quick, but my response is going to be a little bit longer. I'm always struck, you know, I do a lot of leadership management and development and discussions. And one of the things that I often share is confident leaders, you know, that confident leaders often say two things. The second most important thing that they say, in my opinion, in answer to a question like this is, what do you think? Because there's always somebody else that's smarter in the room. You know, if you're an army of one, you're stuck with whatever you think. But if somebody like you, Jim, I mean, look how long we've served together and worked together in uniform. And then, you know, when you were an SES in the building, So my first response is, what do you think? And then the second, well, the most important thing I think confident leaders say is, I don't know. I don't know the answer to this question. So here are the knowns. Go ahead, and I know you're recording this. Run it back to when Jamie started talking and relook at your notes. We have a huge Manning issue. He hit it on the head. So, you know, if I was advising the purchase of the shipyard, I assume that the Koreans have done some homework on this to figure out how they're going to regain the cost of purchase based on throughput. And it's Manning that is the, I think, the holy grail to go after. All kinds of issues, others issues like Jamie pointed out. To me, the known is Manning. They've got to get after the Manning. The unknowns are, what is politically acceptable on the Hill? What is acceptable to unions? What is acceptable to the local community? If I'm assuming these are Korean workers that are coming into the community, does the school system, can they integrate them into the school system? You know, what's the occupation rate for apartments or homes? This is a wicked hard problem. It goes back to what Jamie discussed. I think the fact that there has been very little debate, and I've been watching this closely, very little debate from what I've seen on the implications. I mean, SECNAV, God bless them, spoke up in advocating for this move. And that still didn't generate much of a political debate. I think it's reflective of all the other challenges that we're facing across the political spectrum. But I don't, right now, I'm not sure the jury's been called, much less, you know, to consider the challenge of this is. Let me riff off of Jamie's comment and bring it back to AUKUS. You might make the argument that this is AUKUS in reverse. I'm not saying American shipyard builders are going to go to Australia or the UK, although they do go to Japan. As a 7th Fleet commander, we were highly reliant on shipyard workers in the Seattle yards to come do nuclear work in Japan to keep the carrier standards for the carriers that we had there in Japan. It's all about the workforce. But describe the picture that Jamie just laid out, and we cannot grow the shipyards here physically. We've got to get the Manning piece right. When I look at Manning, Jamie said the sustainment thing. When I talk, we're struggling to meet the requirements of the total cost of force ownership. We don't get that money from Congress. We're manned at 70% or 60%. You know, if you're seeing IC, we're funding our infrastructure, our shore-based infrastructure at 60% at best and 40% in other areas. We have to fully fund sustainment to sustain the force we have. We have to fully fund maintenance. There's a difference between the two, and we have to modernize it. You know, Manning, we're funding it. We're supposed to have, I don't know what the current number is. Back when I was in uniform, it was around 315 sailors on a DDG. We had 270, 275 on a regular basis. It's just another example of what the total cost of ownership is that we as a nation have to pay, and we haven't been paying it up to this point. But add in AUKUS, and now you have the capability to expand in an easier way for me to understand. It's difficult. There's a big debate in Australia about, can they grow the workforce? Just the same discussion that Jamie has led us through here. Can they do that in Australia? It's much easier to grow that workforce if you're doing it in the context of what can we do here in the United States, what can we do in Australia, and what can we do in UK? The percentages in Australia may not be much. The percentages in the UK might not be much, nor in the US. But when you do it from a combined perspective, focused on the same platforms, now you've gotten something real that goes forward. And it goes back to my comment before about the powers of the allies in the context of phase two. It is huge, which includes the industrial base. And that's a large part of those discussion. It's that combined force of allies, partners, and friends working together. Now, the good work that is being done, I'll use an example of some innovation things are being done. The Navy's combining with Huntington Ingalls. We have sailors that never go to sea. They go to a shipyard right out of boot camp, and they stay in that shipyard, never going to sea on their ship, their total enlistment. What do you think their retention rate is? It's they leave. They go do other things. I work with a couple of startups, and the mobility of the workforce, they don't care because they're taking these young kids with incredibly bright minds, bringing them into the company. That doesn't work in an industrial business environment like Huntington Ingalls and Electric Boat up in Quonset are working through. But the Navy's building a parking garage with Huntington Ingalls down on the right adjacent to the shipyard down there to increase the quality of life of workers. One of the things that the workers, Navy sailors and Huntington Ingalls workers, was it's taking too long to commute back and forth. They got to park out in town. They're getting tickets. And the Navy is building a housing area that, my understanding, taking over some derelict apartments, completely refurbishing them to Navy standards, which is pretty high. And that's going to help with that workforce. Those are the kind of integrated things that, you know, Jamie and I are focused on doing what we can. That is enhanced through AUKUS, phase one, in supporting the value that we're going to get out of AUKUS phase two. Close on this point, just to get one eye on the clock here. And that is, I'll channel Bill Lesher, foot stomp the fact that Vecino Kilby is all over this. And CNO is driving it from the driver's seat, and that's get real, get better. So if you listen to her testimony, to Jim Kilby's engagement on the Hill, we have to get real, get better. That is a common thread I've seen throughout AUKUS. So despite the criticism, and I would say the embracement of the criticism that's occurring, let's take those questions and dig into them and get to a facts-based response, both with the phase one piece and the phase two. But you can't talk about phase one without understanding the value that's going to come in phase two. That's where my belief is. I really believe in phase two. The hard part's phase one. Let's roll up our sleeves, get together, as Jamie has pointed out here, and figure out how we can fix these infrastructure problems collectively, together, with the UK, with Australia, with the US. Thank you.
Thanks, Natsu. Jamie, I'd like to wrap this up with a discussion of, you know, how industry can approach DoD. You know, be able to get into the market for AUKUS work and for the SIB effort. You know, Cyprus can certainly help navigate the space. You know, are there other resources that we can go after or that industry could tap into that would help them attend a level of funding in SIB, and, you know, what its goals are and how they can fit into that calculus?
Hey, Jim. Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, there is help available. You know, sometimes breaking through government bureaucracy can be frustrating and challenging, but this time, more than ever, I think we've got to go back to that Hondo Gertz mantra of a public-private partnership to make this work. America needs this, and we need to figure out how to move forward. You know, we've got to get to 100,000 builders in 10 years, and I would submit that if this campaign goes as well as it did in 2023, that we go beyond 100,000, and we export this model to other portions of the industrial base in the United States. So, you know, you have a defense industrial base. We now have a maritime industrial base with the Honorable Jay Stephanie going to take over the lead on that, and a submarine industrial base. It kind of comes in that order if there's a chain of command, if you will. It's kind of like OSD versus, you know, the joint staff and the services. Companies like Blue Forge Alliance, Serco, they're doing their best to get out there, advertise. Stratcom is really important and recruit. And, you know, I think there are other companies that are in assistance. You know, we do some work with, I do some work with Orion Talent. It's a human resources organization that goes around the country and visits naval centers of concentration, you know, bases. And they don't headhunt sailors that are in active duty serving in the fleet. They talk to sailors who are in transition, who are coming through the transition assistance program, who have either finished their career or decided that they're going to do something else for family reasons or other reasons, and they want to find a job that's commensurate with their skill set. And COs of bases and naval support activities are smart. They let these folks in. You know, as sailors are going through the TAP program, and one of my guys over here at the Navy League, Nick Weising, graduate of the College of Labor at Cornell University, a young man just graduated. He's written a couple of great pieces on how we approach that labor. And one of the challenges Nick threw out was, you know, in the transition assistance program, industries are prohibited from going in and talking to these sailors because it's run by OSD and there's a restriction. And you can imagine why. But I just don't think that's logical. If there's a need in the industrial base for skill sets and sailors have welding skills, manufacturing skills, the ability to you know, operate and take on big projects and they want a decent salary in a transition, then companies should be able to go in and give them a pitch. And this is America. Nobody's going to twist your arm. You decide. You have the freedom to decide. So I think we're losing out there. Admiral Swift mentioned Secretary Del Toro. Secretary Del Toro, over a year ago, talked about, you know, if we have an immigration problem in this country, why don't we use this capacity to our benefit? Anybody that was in and out of the Pentagon after the Pentagon was attacked during 9/11 knows that the workers, the men and women, the dedicated men and women out there that were putting that building back together were naturalized citizens or green card carriers. And those guys and gals just sweated their butts off to make sure that we met the requirements to get that building back in fighting order in record time. It was called Phoenix Rising. And I saluted them and admired them. We have an incredible diaspora of Afghans, of Ukrainians in this country with skill sets, engineers, people who are smart, who the United States trained. Let's put them to work. You know, you can recruit enlisted personnel and even officer personnel who are foreign nationals and fast track them for citizenship in the United States. We should be doing the same thing with builders, you know, a Phoenix Rising for our industrial base and taking advantage of this great commodity in our country. People who want to work, people who want to support America and pay taxes, people who want to be patriots, and they've come to this country for the dream, and we should enable that dream for them and at the same time use their skills to help us defend this great nation. You know, there's other stuff out there. I talked about the schoolhouse in Newport News. You got to export that model to every shipbuilder. You know, go out and recruit in the local community or beyond and bring young men and women in who want to be part of the trades. They don't want that big tuition bill. And help build America's industrial base and manufacturing base back up again. There's also a hybrid version of this. We haven't talked about unmanned systems. You know, we talk about unmanned systems and drones and stuff like that. How about unmanned systems in the industrial base? Robotics. The Navy has just embraced a new robotics rating. I was proud of CNO Franchetti. You know, we worked together overseas. So to bring that on, long overdue. You know, there are things that machines can do, you know, I'm not talking ex machina here, but things that machines can do to save on the cost of labor and can do those things better in many cases than a human being can. And I was just talking to Secretary Richard Spencer the other day. I congratulated him on taking over leadership as president and CEO of Austal. And somehow we got on the subject of the additive manufacturing facility that comes under the submarine industrial base in Danville, Virginia. So it's way down south near the North Carolina border. I'm supposed to go there pretty soon and see it. And he said it's magnificent. You know, it's like seven different kinds of additive manufacturing machines that can build small components, large components. And that's part of the goals of the SIP. I think three goals, 10,000 builders a year for 100,000 builders in 10 years, solve or mitigate supply chain problems with additive manufacturing. And my roommate next door here at the Navy League, Admiral John Richardson, was huge on this. It started off with an idea by JOs over a decade ago and his program for innovation called TANG, and it took off. We need to be able to manufacture parts on board our ships instead of, you know, relying on long supply chains that are delivered by FedEx or Amazon to an overseas location and then trucked or heloed out to a port or to a ship so that they can fulfill the need. We got to get better at that. And I'm all in favor of instantaneous gratification and producing those parts on board the ship. As far as plugging in, I think you and Cyprus have some subject matter experts there that are just terrific people. I mentioned Dave Armour on PSYOP. He's forgotten more about PSYOP than I will ever know. And John Newton, a great submariner from the waterfront when I was in command. John is a nuke. John is plugged in all over the place and clearly capable of bringing people together from industry with folks in the Pentagon, whether you wear a suit or wear a uniform, and facilitating that public-private partnership. And there's no better individual than John for being able to do that. And you know what? I got to put a plug in for the leadership. I am impressed current leadership in the Navy and particularly in the submarine force. Back in my day, I was blessed as commanding officer of the USS Oklahoma City. I had three department heads, all of whom went to command. And my engineer was Lieutenant Rick Seif when he reported on the boat. My navigator was Lieutenant Rob Goucher. And next door on USS Hampton, frequent flyer on the Oklahoma City, was Lieutenant Bill Houston. Bill later worked with me on the NPB. Bill was Commander Submarine Group 8 when I was Commander Naval Forces Europe and Africa. Rick Seif became Commander Submarine Force Pacific. He is today Rear Admiral Rick Seif, and Vice Admiral Rob Goucher is the Commander Submarine Force Atlantic. You know, so I tell people when I was in command of the Oklahoma City, I just go up to the bridge and smoke a cigar and let those guys run the boat. And that's the way they run the submarine force. And they are getting after these problems. I just saw both of them last week. Fantastic officers with brilliant ideas. Admiral Goucher talks about his BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals. And he's got the entire submarine force excited. You know, and that's what we want. I want leaders like Admiral Swift who get people excited with his warfighting instructions and Swift signals. And I see that happening today. It makes me feel really good. You know what? It makes me want to go back and sign up and do it all over again. But unfortunately, I had my day, so I just get to be somebody on the sidelines and a cheerleader who supports the fleet. So thanks very much for the opportunity to comment today.
Thanks, gentlemen. I appreciate your time today. You know, obviously, AUKUS and SIB are going to be pretty significant topics here for the near future. So we're looking at building on today's podcast. There'll be a separate AUKUS podcast coming in the near future, and then a separate deep dive on SIB for podcast on that as well over the next couple of months. But your insights were extremely helpful in understanding the overall picture on AUKUS and SIB and where this is going. So I appreciate your comments, and I appreciate your time. Admiral Swift, do you have anything before we close out here?
Yeah, I'll wrap it up quick here, and it goes into the next two podcasts. But, you know, I think that when you asked what clients, anybody listening to this podcast can do, I think the get real, get better piece is important. Equally important, I think, starting off is what not to do. We have not done well in public-private partnerships, for instance, with base housing. And, you know, the housing was in terrible condition, and we threw it over to somebody and expected them to fix it. And it was just really hard to do. So I think that public-private partnerships are the way to go. Work with, for industry, work in those areas where you have expertise, partner with the services, Navy in this instance, to understand what they think their gaps and seams are, have that direct communication with them, and then pursue technology that can help. I think that's the way forward, and I know Cypress can help you doing that. This has been a great discussion, Jim. I'm sure the audience has gotten at least as much out of it as I have, but a great team and super job moderating it.
Thank you very much. Admiral Fogo, any closing comments?
Hey, one guy I forgot to mention at Cypress, Jim, is Jim McCarthy. Jim does a lot of pro bono stuff around town, and last year I invited him over for the Congressional Maritime Intensive. He's coming back this year. And he gave a brief on the POM, on the Navy budget, and he got the highest marks in the critique sheets from the young people that served on both sides of the aisle, for members and for senators, congressmen, and for committees, because they're trying to figure out how to, you know, unwrap this very complicated Navy POM system. So there's folks out there, potential clients or clients that want to understand how our budget works. There is no better than you, Jim. And so Admiral Swift and I salute you, and we hope you stay around for a long time doing this. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the comments. And gentlemen, have a great week, and thanks for your time and comments today.
Okay. Absolutely.
Thanks so much.